I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. Democrats hope that the video version of the Mueller report, delivered in two hearings on Capitol Hill Wednesday by its enigmatic author, would somehow land a knockout blow to the Trump presidency. That didn't happen, and the Democrats remain divided about starting an impeachment inquiry. The Senate Intelligence Committee reports that in 2016, Russians targeted election systems in all 50 states. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell dismisses a Democratic bill to address future foreign meddling as conspiracy theory hype. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing and Brookings Institution scholar Elaine Kmark join me with analysis. Plus, she's appeared in movies and on TV in the U.S. and Europe. And today, cabaret star Mariah Bonner sings for us live in Studio A. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. On Wednesday, Robert Mueller testified for nearly 7 hours in separate hearings in front of the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. It was his 90th appearance before Congress during a career in public service that spans more than three decades. The 74-year-old former FBI director and former special counsel declined to directly answer his congressional interrogators more than 200 times, refusing even to read aloud portions of the report that he'd submitted to the Attorney General in April. So now that the dust from his long-awaited appearance before Congress is beginning to settle, what did we learn about Russian meddling in the U.S. electoral process and President Trump's efforts to thwart the investigation? How will Mueller's testimony affect efforts among some Democrats to begin an impeachment inquiry? Did Mueller change any hearts and minds when it comes to the prospects of a second Trump term? Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing joins us on the line from the NPR studios in Washington. Hey, Phil, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the founding director of the Brookings Center for Effective Public Management. She's on the line from Cape Cod up in Massachusetts. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great, thanks, and welcome back. And listeners, if you'd like to chime in on our conversation about the Mueller hearings and some of the other news of the day, our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To send us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. So, Phil, let me start with you. What do you think? Did Mr. Mueller move the needle for either the Democrats or the Republicans in that testimony?
That is the big question that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and her lieutenants are going to be attuned for an answer about as they go into a summer recess and meet with constituents and try and take the pulse of the nation after the comments given by the special counsel. He said the words that Democrats wanted him to say. He restated the conclusions that he had already found in his investigation in his report from earlier this year. But he wasn't a very dynamic, TV-friendly witness. And as you mentioned earlier, he declined to get into a situation where a member of Congress could just get a good soundbite of him saying things that he'd already written his report, or could ask a number of questions, kind of courtroom deposition style, that would result in him agreeing to the premise of those questions, both for Republicans and Democrats. And if the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, thought that Mueller was going to be kind of a cauterizing moment or a unifying moment for the way he views the outcome of the special counsel investigation, there's kind of an uphill battle to get there from here. But we don't know yet. We don't know quite yet what Americans made of this. We just know, based on the way it appeared to us and the way it kind of played on TV, there was no big capital M moment that came out of the Mueller hearings.
And Elaine Kmark, to a certain extent, these hearings were designed for those folks who haven't really been paying that close attention for the last 2 years.
That's exactly right. I mean, there were really two narratives coming out of the hearings, and I was impressed by how disciplined the members of Congress of both parties were in pursuing their particular narrative. On the Democratic side, the narrative really did focus on President Trump's many attempts to obstruct justice. I think that's pretty clear. The record's pretty clear. And the only reason he was not indicted is because of the Office of Legal Counsel opinion that says you can't indict a sitting president. The Republicans ignored the obstruction of justice charges for the most part and instead went right to the genesis of the investigation itself, attempting through a whole variety of ways to sow doubt on the very investigation that has gone on for so long. And so both of them had their stories. I think they got them across very, very well. And I'm not sure that given how late it is in the game, we are about to start on a presidential election year, I'm not sure anything more will come of this.
And Phil Ewing, what about that? The Democrats scored some points early on in both sessions. Adam Schiff got Mr. Mueller to basically agree that Mr. Trump had welcomed Russian help, that he had formulated his messaging during the campaign based on the information that they gave him, those stolen emails, and then he lied to cover it up. Chairman Nadler in the morning, right from the get-go, in the first 5 minutes, said, you know, can we confirm that you've not exonerated the president? And Mr. Mueller accommodated him on that. What about on the Republican side, this concentration on Fusion GPS and the investigation about where the origins of this inquiry started way back when? Mr. Mueller kept saying it was out of his purview. How did that help or hurt, or maybe perhaps even have remained neutral, the Republican position on that?
He explained that it's out of his purview because the questions that have been raised by the ranking members, in this case on the Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, and other supporters of the president, have to do with areas that are under investigation by the Justice Department today. And these are based on a number of criticisms that Republicans and other supporters of the president have leveled at the FBI and the Justice Department. One of those is they allege authorities in 2016 abused their surveillance powers to get warrants to collect the communications of Carter Page, who was a foreign policy aide who worked for Donald Trump, but who also had many contacts with Russians and traveled to Moscow twice in 2016. And so that story has always been murky, and even the special counsel's office and the House Intelligence Committee in their reports say they don't know what the full story is with Carter Page. The FBI and the Justice Department's own internal investigators are looking into that. There's also questions that have been raised about the way the FBI used confidential informants in the early stages of this investigation in 2016 to try and substantiate claims that had come in through a circuitous route about the overtures that were being made by Russia's government to Donald Trump's campaign. An Australian diplomat had drinks one night in London with a guy named George Papadopoulos, who worked in London for Trump. And after a couple of pints, Papadopoulos told him he had been getting these offers from Russians about help with dirt on Hillary Clinton, with her emails, with so-called off-the-record meetings that he could have with Russians, or that even Trump himself could have with Russians, because they were interested in supporting Trump's candidacy. Now, that strategic picture we know is correct and has been substantiated to a fare-thee-well by the special counsel's office. There's a nearly 500-page report about it that you can read. The fact of the Russian support for Trump and its interference in the election has been established beyond, I think most people would agree, a reasonable doubt. However, what did the FBI do in those first days after getting that information in terms of using confidential informants to meet with Papadopoulos and meet with others in the UK and potentially elsewhere? Republicans want answers to that question. That's part of this attempt to undermine the integrity of the investigators and the investigation itself, because for so long, when we didn't know what it was going to resolve, they wanted to suggest that this was the product of bias by investigators, that one or two or a few other anti-Trump FBI agents or FBI officials had ginned this whole thing up out of partisan animus against the president. The story doesn't hold together as a narrative because it relies on you accepting that these officials would then allow Trump to be elected and then only later try and harass him with this investigation after the fact, and so the story kind of, the story itself doesn't make sense, but that's not what this is about. This is about having a parallel narrative and parallel questions, which could be damaging and embarrassing to the FBI in the way that other aspects of the story have been damaging and embarrassing to the FBI going forward. Republicans are looking forward to the results of these internal investigations into surveillance authorities, the use of confidential informants, and potentially other things coming from the Justice Department at some point soon. The Attorney General, Bill Barr, has said they might come out this summer, but we don't know precisely when we could get these IG or other reports about the way these investigations took place. We also don't know what else they could reveal. There also may be other things about this story that we could learn going forward that we don't already know. For example, the former British intelligence officer, Christopher Steele, who wrote the infamous Russia dossier, which is its own whole thing, has reportedly talked with these internal Justice Department investigators for many hours, and he's said things to them, according to press reports, that led them to want to continue their investigation as opposed to close it up and issue a report. We don't know what those are. We don't know whether American investigators found something more interesting out of Steele that they want to continue to pursue. So we don't know what we don't know. But when you heard Republicans this week cast forward to the results of those investigations, to what the Attorney General, U.S. Attorney John Durham, and the Justice Department's Inspector General are doing, that's what they were describing.
And Elaine K. Mark, what's your take on the validity of the Republican case that the Steele dossier and Fusion GPS, et cetera, and the origins of this investigation were spurious to begin with? I mean, do they, in your estimation, you know, is there a valid reason for looking into it? I mean, certainly the Republicans are happy that Mr. Barr has decided to do that, but what do you think?
I think, by and large, they don't hold up, and I don't think they will hold up. I think this is an attempt, including invoking very obscure players like Joseph Misbud, who nobody even knows who he is, right, or where he is, or if he's alive.
There's some question as to whether or not he exists, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I think that a lot of this is an attempt to create an alternative story that cast doubt on the investigation. And if, in fact, the investigation is so outrageous and such fake news and so, out of the blue, that then they have a reason, and some of the Republicans alluded to this, they say, well, no wonder President Trump just, you know, tweeted these things and kind of went off the handle. Look how frustrating it was to be completely an innocent person and accused of all of these things. So what they're trying to do is say this was so outrageous and so made up that whatever the president may have done in terms of obstructing justice, you know, you can kind of understand it from a human perspective. And more than one person said that. I also think that what we're going to see going forward, and I may be jumping ahead a little bit, is that, you know, in Watergate, what started out as a third-rate burglary ended up being a broad indictment of the actions of the Richard Nixon's reelection committee and all sorts of illegal activities then poured out of it. It may well be that, in fact, there was, as the president has been saying, there's no collusion. The president may have had very little to do with Russians per se. But, in fact, what this is doing is this is opening up a very, very strange world of Donald Trump's business dealings and financial entanglements with Russia. And as we know a lot about Russia, we know a lot about Russian intelligence. Unlike the United States, Russian intelligence and the Russian banking system and the Russian government are deeply entangled with each other. So I think that, in fact, there may be a lot more damning information coming down the pike. It's just that the boundaries around the Mueller investigation kind of precluded him from going there, but the hints were there right throughout the day of hearings on Wednesday.
Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Phil Ewing is NPR's national security editor. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have more with Phil Ewing and Elaine Kmark. 410-662-8780 to get involved on the phone. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up a little later today, the actress and cabaret singer Mariah Bonner joins me here in Studio A to sing a few tunes in advance of her appearance at Germano's Piattini in Little Italy tonight. And looking ahead to Monday on Midday, the actor and LGBTQ activist George Takei will be my guest. He's going to discuss his new memoir about the years he spent with his family in an internment camp for Japanese Americans during the Second World War. His illustrated memoir is titled They Call Us Enemy. George Takei joins us for the hour Monday here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Mueller edition of the Midday News Wrap. My guests are Elaine Kmark of the Brookings Institution and Phil Ewing of NPR. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We will try to sneak in a phone call or two if we can. Let's go to Richard in Lockhart. Richard, welcome to Midday with Phil Ewing and Elaine Kmark.
Good afternoon. My assessment of the Mueller appearance in front of the committees is that for most Republicans, certainly in Congress and for many in the United States, they don't care who picked their president as long as they lower their taxes.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Richard. I appreciate it. And Phil Ewing, in terms of scoring points, and I hate to be one of those people that gets involved in the sort of horse race dimension of all of this, but you did have Republicans making some statements that places like PolitiFact rated quite false. I mean, Representative Ratcliffe from Texas accused the special counsel of not following the regulations of his order from the Department of Justice. Representative Mike Johnson from Louisiana stated that the president cooperated fully with the investigation, and there's ample evidence to suggest neither of those things are true. But in terms of news, for me at least, the contention by the special counsel that Mr. Trump can be charged if he's out of office, meaning if he's not elected, reelected in 2020, and the statute of limitations hasn't expired by then, that he could be charged with counts of obstruction, et cetera. Other than that, was there any big news to your ears?
Well, one thing it was interesting to hear the special counsel say in his own voice was that this is an ongoing issue, and other national security officials, including the day before here in Washington, FBI Director Christopher Wray, have said that election interference is going to be the new normal, for lack of a better term, in our political environment, at least for the next few cycles. And Mueller agreed in his second hearing with the questioning from Texas Republican Congressman Will Hurd that not only was this an issue in 2016, as his report documented, but it continued to be an issue in 2018, and it will be an issue through the 2020 race. And hearing Mueller say that, even though that has been the official position of the national security establishment in Washington, was significant because Robert Mueller is probably the single biggest expert on election interference and the foreign peril from active measures, as they're called, of anyone in the United States. The question is what the United States is going to do about that. And there was an attempt by Democrats after Mueller's testimony to try and seize some momentum following that warning with a call for new legislation involving some proposals about new funding or new changes to law. But the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, is very cool about a new bill. And he has both practical objections and philosophical objections to anything taking place going forward. we're still waiting to see where the public and where members of Congress land politically after Mueller. But if, in fact, we have the status quo in terms of McConnell's position and the state of play in Congress, the other takeaway from last week might have been the opportunity for us to say the door is now closed on a bill between now and Election Day 2020. So in terms of the legal or legislative playing field for candidates, Republican and Democrat, and foreign powers, we may be able to say that we'll be living in the same world from now until then. The practices of the national security infrastructure of federal, state, and local officials in terms of election security has changed a great deal. That was the subject of a report on Thursday this week by the Senate Intelligence Committee, saying that although 2016 was a huge wake-up call for all of those authorities in terms of election interference and the danger from active measures launched by foreign governments, at least according to the Senate report, the United States is in a better position today than it was at that time. The proof of the pudding will be in the tasting, obviously. And the other difference is, you know, Americans are going to be prepared for this going forward in a way that they weren't in 2016. A lot of people have talked about the 2016 story as a failure of imagination by not only President Barack Obama and his administration as to what was taking place or the magnitude of the implications of those interference, but also the lack of preparedness at every level from everyone to deal with such a complex threat. That won't be the case anymore. We've gone through that evolution. We've gone through the Russia investigation, and at least for many voters, many officials, and the top leaders of the national security world, they're going to be on their guard for interference, for social media agitation, for cyber attacks, et cetera, in a way they weren't before.
Here's a brief clip of Congressman Will Hurd, a Republican from Texas, and Mr. Mueller concerning Russia.
Is this, in your investigation, did you think that this was a single attempt by the Russians to get involved in our election, or did you find evidence to suggest they'll try to do this again?
Oh, it wasn't a single attempt. They're doing it as we sit here, and they expect to do it during the next campaign.
And Elaine K. Mark, you've written about dirty tricks in campaigns. They go back a long, long time to the 30s,
yes,
the 40s. But there is a different vibe, a different capacity for social media and dirty tricks that didn't exist in the 50s, the 60s, even the 80s and 90s, that exists now. It's cheaper, it's faster, it's easier to hide. You've written about that for Brookings. Is there any data now that you're aware of that calculates the efficacy of Russians' ability to change votes? We know that even though they were involved, according to Senator Burr and the Senate Intel Committee, they were involved in some way or another in all 50 states trying to influence what's happening on the actual election systems themselves. There doesn't seem to be any evidence they succeeded, but they probably learned a lot. But is there any evidence, or how much evidence is there, that they actually change people's votes one way or the other?
Well, there's two ways to change a vote, right? One is to actually interfere in the count. And we know that they tried to break into election systems. We don't think there's much evidence that they actually changed the count as it was coming in. But the second way is to basically engage either in disinformation or in actions that suppress the vote. We do know, for instance, that out of their 126 million people that the Russian disinformation campaigns reached, there were places where fake American groups of African Americans, for instance, put forth messages that essentially said, vote for Jill Stein. The two candidates are just the same. There's no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And in fact, in two states at least, we saw a big drop in the African American vote. One of them was Detroit, Wayne County, where the drop from Obama to Clinton was about 70,000. And if you'll remember, Trump only won the state by 10,000. And the other place was Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is the area of Wisconsin that has the largest concentration of African Americans. And that vote drop was about 40,000. And if you'll remember, Trump won the state by around 20,000. So it looks very much like in two states, they did manage to affect a very critical Democratic vote. Now, at the time, people said, well, of course, black turnout fell off because, you know, Hillary wasn't black and Obama was. But frankly, you know, Al Gore and John Kerry and perfectly, you know, many other candidates had gotten strong support from the African-American communities. This was pretty dramatic, and I think you can probably make a good guess that this had something to do with very effective disinformation campaigns on the part of the Russians.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting that now we're calling it a disinformation campaign, which certainly it was, but this is very redolent of, the 2000 election when Ralph Nader told his voters that there's no difference between Al Gore and George Bush. I mean, so vote for me. So, you know, whether it's coming from a candidate or the internet.
The thing that makes it disinformation is that these were not real Americans broadcasting this. Ralph Nader was a real American. Unfortunately, he did have some people in Florida who followed his lead. The reason I call it disinformation was that these were made-up African Americans. These were made-up groups. These were made-up people.
Sure.
And the St. Petersburg outfit used these as fronts to essentially convince Americans that, there were other people thinking this and that maybe they should pay attention to it.
Yeah.
That's the big difference.
And, of course, Phil Ewing, it comes down to, in part, and you mentioned this earlier in the show, over the next 6 weeks when Congress goes home and holds town hall meetings to assess the climate for impeachment, it remains to be seen whether or not the movement towards impeachment would take place or not. This is what Speaker Pelosi had to say about it yesterday.
My position has always been whatever decision we made in that regard would have to be done with our strongest possible hand, and we still have some outstanding matters in the courts. It's about the Congress, the Constitution, and the courts. And we are fighting the president in the courts.
And Phil Ewing, the Boston Globe reports 96 Democrats in favor of impeaching or beginning an impeachment inquiry now. There are different people who have different totals when they do the head counts. I mean, do you think that these hearings move things any closer or any further away from an impeachment inquiry? And what's your expectation about the courts and the various cases that are in front of them? The fact that Mr. Barr, for example, the attorney general, has refused to honor the subpoena for Congress, that kind of thing. How do you see this playing out in the next few months?
One mind that was apparently not changed by the special counsel testimony was that of the speaker, as we heard from her just a moment ago. She had a press conference after these hearings with her three key chairmen, Elijah Cummings of Maryland, Adam Schiff of California, and Jerry Nadler of New York. And although Mr. Nadler reportedly has been a hawk on impeachment, or has been advocating for an impeachment proceeding inside the family because it would come in part from his committee. The speaker's mind apparently was not changed by Mueller's testimony. She has tried to keep the door open by saying that maybe there are things that we can uncover, or maybe there are going to be results of our own investigations or this litigation that she's launched against the president to try to get his tax returns and business records and other material that would make that pertinent down the line. But she's also a realist, and the speaker came out of the 2018 midterm elections in which she won a majority and became speaker again after a years-long period in the minority with a program that focused on health care and prescription drugs and a policy message to voters separate and apart from Donald Trump, even though Donald Trump, as we know, is very unpopular with Democrats. But Pelosi's calculation is that talking about policy, talking about health care and other things is more popular with more people than talking about Trump and potentially impeaching Trump is with the liberals in her party, who she knows hate the president, but which may not have much more of an appeal beyond them. And to hear her talk about it, she will not close the door in the way that she's never closed the door. But what she basically said was she wouldn't go ahead with impeachment against Trump unless she believed that a majority of Americans supported it. That's a very long road to hoe, and I don't think we're going to get there no matter what happens over the coming summer break for Congress unless something very dramatic happens. But another lesson of Mueller's investigation in his report and his hearings is that even very dramatic things, which under normal circumstances you might consider these to be, don't move the needle with Americans anymore. In fact, this was a comment that Congressman Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, made to NPR after the Mueller hearings when he was on our show, All Things Considered. Even he has gotten to the point where he didn't expect this to really change the minds of people who were firmly in Trump's camp or theoretically might have been on the fence. And if that remains the state of play, I think you'll see a much more confident Speaker Pelosi after this recess, depending on the way these member visits go back in home districts, talking about other things besides impeachment and, in fact, besides the Russia imbroglio itself. And what Mueller's hearings might have been is the final kind of curtain coming down on him and his era, because Democrats might decide for their own electoral purposes to just talk about other things. The other barometer to watch for that in terms of the politics will be the debate scheduled for next week in Detroit, in which the 2020 hopefuls, including former Vice President Biden, Senator Warren, Senator Sanders, and all the others, are going to appear over two nights and talk about their policy positions for the 2020 election.
Yeah.
If they don't focus on Russia and Mueller and the investigation, that will be very significant, because it will show that they, too, want to move on from this.
Yeah, Elaine?
Could I get a word in briefly on this? I think that the metric has been incorrect about impeachment really from the get-go. It is irrelevant how many Democrats support impeachment. The metric has always needs to be how many Republicans support impeachment. That has been Pelosi's metric from the beginning. And it is the correct metric, because we cannot make, as we saw with President Clinton, the attempt to impeach Clinton. Impeachment should not be a partisan activity. Impeachment has to be something that both parties come together around. They did that in Watergate. In Watergate, the reason Nixon resigned before his impeachment was a visit from Senator Barry Goldwater and a group of Republicans telling him that there were not the votes in the Senate to save him. And so from the beginning, what we should have been looking at and what we should look at going forward is not the number of Democrats, but the number of Republicans. And so far, the Republican Party has held firmly behind the president. There's one Republican member of Congress who said that they think the president should be impeached. Secondly, out of Nancy Pelosi's majority, there are 31 members of Congress Democrats who won in districts that Trump carried. And therefore, that's Pelosi's majority. She has to be careful to protect the interests of those members going forward. And rushing into impeachment with no Republican support would not be the way to protect them.
And just as we finish up quickly here, Phil Ewing, the question perhaps really does come down to an exchange that struck me between Adam Schiff and Mr. Mueller, when Mr. Schiff said, "We should hold our elected officials to a standard higher than mere avoidance of criminality, correct?" And Mr. Mueller answered that question quite forcefully in a way that he hadn't answered many other questions, and he said, "Absolutely." So the question is, do Americans agree with that? And what standard is Mr. Trump to be held to? Your quick thoughts as we finish up.
Well, there'll be a referendum on that question in 2020. And the one thing that Americans will be able to say about that election that may not have been possible to say in previous elections is these factual matters will have been well investigated and well ventilated ahead of that choice that people are going to make more than a year from now. And many of us will be watching very closely to see which way they decide.
Phil Ewing is the National Security Editor at NPR. Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks to you both. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Going to take a quick break, and then we have a musical treat. The cabaret singer and film actress Mariah Bonner and pianist Marcus Dagan are going to share a few tunes with us live right here in Studio A. We're going to be broadcasting it, streamcasting it, live streaming it on Facebook. So key it up if you'd like to. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stick around.
This is 88.1 WYPR.